Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, Mr. Seaman, and counsel for the amicus entities. My name is Tom Thomason. I'm here representing the petitioner appellant, Donald Francis Smith. Forgive me if I get a little bit into a trial mode. I'm a little charged. I was supposed to start a two-week medical malpractice case this afternoon. We settled last night at 11, so if I'm a little edgy, that's the reason. It's lack of sleep. I do want to save some time for Mr. Hansen on the amicus brief. The issues in this case, as the court well knows, are slightly different than those in the predecessor case. The issues in this case are how shall the items of medical expense be treated in either pretrial issues or presentation of the evidence to the jury during trial. And this is an issue that is plaguing the trial courts immensely, which I think this court is well aware by the number of different orders that have been submitted. The orders that have been submitted seem, just based on what we have anecdotally, to indicate that most of the trial court judges are ruling that the amount of medical bills that were billed is what's going to be admitted at the time of trial. There is a lesser number of courts who are saying, no, I believe the correct measure is that which was paid. And then we have the case here, in this case, Judge Pratt. And he held that both should go in, both the billed amount and the paid amount, which creates quite a conundrum trying to figure out how to present that from an evidentiary standpoint during the course of the trial. So those are the three issues that are before the court. Which should be the proper measure of damages to be presented to the jury during the course of the trial by the parties and the litigants, and what would be reflective of Colorado law. Now, Justice Hobbs said earlier that he felt the common law in Colorado was reflective of the fact that the amount paid was, in fact, the measure. Your Honor, I would disagree. I would disagree in this way. If you go back to the case law prior to the codification of the collateral source doctrine, we can go all the way back to, and these are cited in my brief, but you got the Denver and Rio Grande case from 1897, and that said the plaintiff could recover the amount of medical expenses billed, regardless of whether paid, as the defendant's liability was not altered, no matter what arrangement the plaintiff made for their payment or whether she ever paid the bills. Again, if you look at an early case from the Colorado Supreme Court, Denver City Tramway, 1911, the plaintiff was entitled to recover the reasonable and necessary medical expenses caused by the tortfeasor's actions. Then if you look at the case that's most often cited in the trial courts for the proposition of paid is some evidence, that's the Kendall versus Hargrave case, and that's our Colorado Supreme Court from 1960. But if you look at the tenet of that case, it says, while the correct measure of damages is the necessary and reasonable value of the services rendered rather than the amount which may have been paid for such services. If you stop at that point, that's the holding in Kendall. The other hallmark that you have in the case law in Colorado is the Restatement Second of Torts, 920A, Comment B. And what the restatement says is a benefit that is directed to the injured party should not be shifted so as to become a windfall for the tortfeasor. Here's my thinking on this. All of that case law, and there's a lot more in my brief other than what I just cited. I wanted to cite some key points. But all of that case law came into the statute when it was codified in 1986. And in order to give some meaning to the prior common law, which I think, I hope, is reflective of common sense, the contract exception came about as a result of Senator Micheljohn. So the common law is embodied in the contract exception. Now, when we get to presenting evidence to the jury, I don't think anybody in this courtroom disagrees that it is the reasonable and necessary value of the medical services rendered. That ought to be our premise. That ought to be our initial hallmark. That ought to be our base. I think we go way astray when we start worrying about insurance contracts, insurance implications, et cetera. And getting back to the questions, and I apologize, I was behind a pillar. So I couldn't see exactly who was asking the questions. But here, if you look at the Bynum case, Bynum versus Magno, the Supreme Court of Hawaii, 2004, I think that case is really instructive. What do we do about not only present medical expenses, but what do we do about future medical expenses? For example, these insurance issues that have been mentioned here this morning, what does the insured bargain for when they want to go buy insurance? It's a panoply. I mean, I could say that I want the very best coverage, but I only want, in my instance, I can tell you personally through United Healthcare, I want a $2,500 annual deductible for myself. And I know that I'm going to pay that amount, and then I know that I've got to pay some co-amounts, and I know I've got to pay some co-payments, and if it's in-network, out-of-network, I may have to pay more. But then I've got a lot of clients who come into my office and they say, I can't pay the kind of premiums you pay, and I won't pay them. So I take out a catastrophic policy, and I say that I'm going to incur the first $25,000 of medical expense, and then after that I have a copayment, and then it is fully paid for by my carrier. So if we try and fashion a rule of law in this case that tries to take into effect insurance, I think we are grossly remiss, because what do we do about the indigents? What do we do, and if you start talking about in the future, how is a court, or how are litigants, or how are jurors expected to try and predict expenses in the future if people are going to be insured, uninsured, indigent, unable to get insurance because of pre-existing conditions? So the hallmark we have to go with as a bare minimum is, it is the reasonable value of the medical services rendered. The reasonable value of the medical services rendered is the billed amount. And that's where we start from. If, in fact, the billed amount is inflated, if, in fact, the billed amount is grossly disproportionate to what Porter Memorial Hospital is charging compared to what Presbyterian St. Luke's is charging, trust me, there are many excellent, excellent lawyers representing the defense side who will clearly call people into court to bring out those discrepancies. And ultimately, it is the function of the jury to determine what is the reasonable value. Besides,
can I,
if they're...
stop you there?
I apologize. I said I was in trial mode.
I know. Whoa. Okay. But then why does the actual amount that is charged not relevant to this analysis? I mean, I guess just getting to the point of the case, what, I mean, I guess your position is we should just look at the amount billed.
Correct.
But you can bring in other evidence, but not the amount that was actually charged. I mean, the negotiated amount.
You mean the amount that was paid?
Yeah.
I think instead of charged, I think, Your Honor, meant the amount that was paid. The reason you can't look at that, Your Honor, is, and I'll get to a concluding remark here because I do want to leave some time for Mr. Hansen, but here's the problem that you run into with that problem. Every trial becomes a mini trial. Every trial becomes a situation of the instance I just gave to you. I, as the plaintiff, have to get on the witness stand and say, I bought United Healthcare Plan 1, and I chose a $2,500 or $300 or $3,000 deductible. The very next case that comes before the court, another plaintiff gets up and says, God, I couldn't afford to pay what Mr. Thomason did, so I took the $6,000 annual deductible that I have to pay out of my own pocket. And those are all different payment arrangements. Those are all different reimbursement arrangements. And so the court is faced on a rolling scale with what does this case present? As opposed to a uniform rule that applies to all cases, every case becomes an individual circumstance. And so a tortfeasor can greatly benefit in the same courthouse either by, well, I take that back. The tortfeasor can benefit by whomever he hits or injures or causes damage to, as to whether that tortfeasor is ending up having to pay more or less than a similarly situated tortfeasor. It's not equitable. It's not justice.
Well, but I guess I hear you. Your response to my question is not that necessarily that sort of evidence is not relevant. It's just too complicated.
Well,
to go down that path.
Let's talk about that. This is a 401, 403 issue. It is irrelevant. It is irrelevant. That's my position.
Okay.
And to the extent that it is relevant, if somebody wants to argue that paid has some relevancy, if you want to take that dicta in Kendall and say, oh, yes, it has some relevancy, that relevancy is far outweighed by 403. And the reason it's outweighed by 403 is confusion. I mean, a jury is sitting there in any one given case going, well, let's see, they billed $50,000, but in this case, $10,000 was paid. Geez, I guess, I don't know, what should we award? I want to reserve some time. The hallmark, I just love this case. I found it recently. It's Locke versus Van der Ark, and I cited it in my brief. And that was a medical malpractice case where essentially, if you start delving into issues on cross-examination of whether the doctor's been sued, not been sued, what did he settle the case, did he litigate the case or whatever, this court basically said, you know, the sideshow will take over the circus. We just can't have all these mini trials going on within a general trial. It will just unduly burden the courts and the litigation of the case. We end up with an entire sideshow that takes away from the central issue of the injury that occurred, the damages that resulted, and the compensation that ought to be awarded. And I'll get out of my trial mode and I'll sit down unless there are any other questions. Yes, Justice Coates.
The way you used the term paid there in response to your question, to your discussion with Justice Ide, I take it we're talking about more than paid here. By paid, you mean that was accepted by the provider in full discharge of the debt. Is that right?
It could be. That could be, Your Honor, because here's the issue. And it's different in every case, and that's the difficult part. I go to a provider, and when I go into the hospital, as I did recently on an emergent basis, I've got a bill from the hospital. I've got a bill from, in this case, three doctors. Each one was different. The doctors all billed me what they thought their services were. Some were in network, some were out of network. I had to pay some of them personally a larger sum, some a lesser sum. The insurance company paid them a greater sum or a lesser sum based on the fact of whether they were in network or out of network. And the hospital was just another total entity that I'm still arguing over, because I ended up having to pay the hospital my $3,000 annual deductible, and yet there are still issues going back and forth between UnitedHealthcare and the hospital. So my point, coming to that as a personal example, anecdotally, is it just creates a sideshow to the circus. I mean, everything just becomes so untenable. It is, paid is not an easily defined term. In my own personal case, there are four scenarios of what was paid and different reasons as to why, in each circumstance, a different amount was paid. I hope I've left enough time for Mr. Hansen.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Seaman. I'm here representing the respondent in the Smith versus Jepson case. I'm humbled by the fact that I'm before this court, but also by the fact that I'm in front of so many of my peers that have an interest in this case. Is a pretty full courthouse today. So, you know, from the briefs that have been submitted, both in the Tucker case and in the Smith case, that this is an issue of high interest right now in Colorado. It's an issue that the courts have been wrestling with for some period of time, and the wrestling match got even fiercer, I guess, after the Tucker case was decided and the trial court started to apply that case. I'd like to respond in starting to the question that Justice Coates asked Mr. Thompson last, and that is whether when we're talking about the amount paid, that we're really talking about not just the amount paid, but what is accepted by the provider as payment in full. And my answer to that is really an unqualified yes. That is what we're talking about, because these contracts are written so that the insured who incurs a medical expense does not have an out-of-pocket liability for the discount or the write-off or however you want to term that. Now, Mr. Thompson cites examples of people treating out of network, people having higher deductibles, people paying a larger percentage under their particular contract. But those damages are recoverable by that individual. We're not talking about in the sense of defining the damages that are recoverable for medical expenses, making the injured party absorb that loss if they incurred a higher out-of-pocket expense. We're just not. What we're talking about and what the issue is when you talk about billed versus paid as a shorthand way of looking at this is just that. How much was actually paid or incurred as a obligation to that medical provider, and the amount often is substantially less than what is billed. There's been some statements made here this morning that the amount billed it represents the reasonable value of those services, and I would suggest to this court that that is no longer true at all, that the amount that is now being billed by medical providers is an imaginary number. It's a hypothetical number that medical providers don't expect to get paid. They are not getting paid that amount, and the amount could actually be set at any figure that they want to set. Imagine a situation where you create a rule of damages or a recovery of damages where you say that the plaintiff is entitled to recover the amount that is billed, regardless of what that amount is or what its relationship is to the amount paid. Pretty soon you have medical providers, particularly in an automobile litigation scenario, who are advertising their services based upon the fact that we guarantee that we bill the largest amount of any medical provider in our field, and from a plaintiff's standpoint, that's a good thing because that's what you would recover as damages if you were had the misfortune of being involved in an accident. And I would submit to the court that that's ludicrous. That the whole concept
of Mr. Seaman, when you go the opposite direction and suggest, as I believe you did earlier, that the reasonable value is instead the amount paid.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if I led you to believe that, and I do not want to take away from the argument presented in Tucker, which is an excellent argument in terms of how the deduction or reduction applied by the trial court should work and whether they should reduce the entire amount. But in my view of the case that I'm here arguing, Judge Pratt decided in November that the jury should consider both the amount billed and the amount paid, and that the jury is then instructed by the court that their function is to determine the reasonable value, reasonable necessary value of medical services that were incurred as a result of the negligence of the tortfeasor. So in our estimation, we reached the evidentiary viewpoint or the evidentiary point, both numbers should come before the jury. Why should a jury be shielded from or have the number that was actually paid concealed from that jury in deciding what that reasonable figure is?
I assume that's right. It's relevant. What about the 403 implication of insurance?
You know, in that respect, Your Honor, it's ironic. Last time I appeared before this court, it was on a Rule 21 petition, and we made this, well, that was a brilliant argument, and 3 days later I got an order from the court to withdrawing the show cause order as improvidently granted. I thought, why did I bother?
It was a convincing performance.
Okay. it was character building nonetheless. I think what you're overlooking in this whole process is the fact that the jury that is receiving this evidence is not receiving it in a vacuum. They're also receiving jury instructions from the court as to what to do with the evidence. It's ironic in the today over at the Denver District Court, where I understand that the Court of Appeals is now hanging out because they don't have one of these nice courtrooms that you have. They're hearing a case called Sunahara versus State Farm, which is a case that went to trial in the billed versus paid issue. Was presented in that case. Difference between that case and the case that we're here arguing today on a Rule 21 petition is that the jury received instructions, and one of the instructions told them what to do with that evidence, and one of the instructions told them that they could not deny recovery of benefits to the plaintiff because of insurance that paid for the medical expenses. But the important thing was that they also were allowed to consider what was actually paid by that health insurance company in deciding what was reasonable and necessary. And I think that's the key element in terms of trying one of these cases and instructing the jury, is to let the jury know what the facts are.
Could you respond to Mr. Thomason's argument that would be
assigned
to
a
taking? I don't think that a properly instructed jury, first of all, I don't think that most trial judges are going to allow the sideshow to overtake the circus. And certainly, you can predict anything in terms of how the case is going to be presented to a jury. You're going to bring in, you know, actuarials and, you know, insurance experts and so forth. But I don't think the cases that are actually going to be tried are going to be tried in that fashion. I think the jury is going to know that there was insurance. They don't have to know that it's insurance, but they're going to figure it out, just like they did. If you think back to the no-fault or PIP days, we presented evidence all the time of medical expense that was paid by PIP carriers, and then at the end of the trial, the jury was instructed that they could not include as damages for medical expenses anything that fell within the PIP formula, if you will. And the instruction actually said the reason we're telling you not to award those damages is that they were paid by another source. I don't think the sideshow will overtake the circus in a properly run trial by trial judges that are competent and experienced in this area, and particularly with regard to the ability to instruct jurors on what to do with that evidence. And I think the trade-off, I think the opposite of that is to try a case to a jury that is left in the dark and really misled in terms of what the reasonable value of these medical services are.
Would it drive up the cost of these jury trials to the point where a relatively small case is paying?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, certainly the cost of litigating any case in today's world, you know.
Isn't that something we ought to consider?
I think that there's, you know, a reason for the court to be concerned about how this is going to affect the cost, but I think that the bigger concern is that if you allow plaintiffs to recover the amount that is billed and disregard altogether the amount that's paid and not allow the jury to recover that, it's guaranteed to run up the cost of health care, which in turn is going to increase the cost of health insurance. There's several excellent amicus briefs that were filed in the Tucker part of what the court is considering today, talking about those public policy considerations. One of them that was filed by COPIC talks about what decisions like this will do to the cost of malpractice insurance premiums, which is then passed on to the, you know, health consumers, the people that are receiving that treatment. It leaves the doctors in the situation where they've got three choices. They either absorb that loss, they pass it on to their patient in terms of higher medical costs, or they leave the state of Colorado and go practice in Missouri or somewhere that may have a more friendly situation or environment in terms of how those medical malpractice premiums are being paid. I think that there are concerns in terms of running up costs, but I think that there possibility in terms of litigation costs. I think there is certainty in terms of insurance costs, both in terms of not only that example was malpractice, but the biggest area in which this is going to land is going to be in automobile litigation, because those are the vast majority of the cases that are being tried. And one of the things that you can't lose sight of, or I think the court should at least keep in mind, is we're not just talking about increasing the cost of auto insurance premiums, because that certainly would occur if these additional damages have to be paid. But you're also creating a potential exposure to everybody who is driving and buying insurance to an excess exposure. The AAA does an annual survey of the cost of owning and driving a car, and the one that just came out uses as a assumption the cost of a liability policy that has limits of 100,000 per person, 300,000 per accident. If the defendant in a lawsuit is exposed to or is liable to pay damages, not based upon what is actually paid for medical expenses, but what based upon what some medical provider puts down in the original bill, there's not enough insurance out there, most people don't recognize or understand that. Now, maybe the answer is that the agents need to sell more insurance, bigger policies, more umbrellas, but I don't see how that benefits the motoring public or the general public that the court ought to at least look out for or take their, you know, interest into consideration.
Counsel, can I stop here and ask you, how do you think this case relates to our first case? I mean, how does the collateral storage statute in your world relate to your question?
I think that Judge Pratt got it right, that the collateral source statute really doesn't address the evidentiary issue. I know there's been argument in several of the briefs have been filed that the collateral source statute has both an evidentiary component and a substantive component. But when the legislature enacted the collateral source statute or codified collateral source into a statute, I don't think the legislature contemplated or provided for what would happen in an evidentiary standpoint as far as how a case like this would be presented to a jury. So I think, again, if this court is charged with the responsibility of interpreting that statute, and I don't think the statute is vague or ambiguous, and therefore I think it ought to be interpreted and applied as it's written, then I don't think it really goes to the evidentiary issue. The reason it is involving the evidentiary issue, I think even more so now than, you know, say, pre-Tucker, is that Tucker, you know, came out with this broad pronouncement that juries are not even going to be able to consider or hear evidence of the amount that was actually paid. And I think, you know, in looking at the evidentiary issue, you have to go back to the basics, and the basics with regard to medical expense damages is what is the reasonable and necessary amount of those medical expenses. And to determine that, I think juries ought to be given all of the facts, including the amount that was paid, including the amount that was billed, evidence or testimony on both amounts.
It seems to be consistent with the evidentiary rule that all relevant evidence should come in, and also with the jury method of
We placed, you know, I've done this for 37 years and I've tried a lot of jury trials, and I know enough from that experience to know that jurors are smart and they understand what they're hearing, and they certainly understand, and there's a bunch of case law to say that they are presumed to follow the court's instructions. And this court has the ability to provide input into those instructions if it chooses to allow jurors in these types of cases to hear evidence of the amount that was actually paid. Fashion and jury instruction that tells the jurors that they cannot ignore the fact that these are actual medical expenses and that the plaintiff is entitled to recover them even if their insurance company has paid them. I wanted to comment on one earlier comment that was made, and that had to do with the idea of subrogation and the notion that under a subrogation claim, if someone is found to be 49% at fault and they only recover 51% of their damages, that they are still liable for 100% of the amount paid by their health insurance. I started out 37 years ago as a subrogation attorney, and that simply is not the case. A subrogee stands in the shoes of the insured with respect to that, and if there's not any liability, and there's not liability to pay for damages that are not recoverable against the tortfeasor, so there's no basis for a health insurance carrier to come in and say, you know, even though you were only 49% at fault, and so therefore you're recovering part of your damages, we want all of our damages. That simply is not going to fly under Colorado law. Are there any other questions that the panel has of me?
I do one, yes. If we interpreted the collateral source rule as I suspect you are suggesting, and that is so that after the jury verdict, the amount is being adjusted so that there's no compensation for what doesn't actually have to be paid. Should that understanding of the collateral source rule play a role? This goes back to Justice's Ide's question that's a little more specific. Play a role in the court's determination of the evidentiary issue of whether the evidence of the amount paid should be admitted. That is, there are some complexities, and we can quibble, I think, about how complex, and it's probably going to vary from case to case. But should the issues of confusion of issues and waste of time take into account the fact that it all sorts out, by your view, with the collateral source rule after the verdict anyway? In other words, trial judge said, no point in getting into all of that, we'll take the amount billed, that gets adjusted out later anyway.
You know, it's an interesting question, and I go back to thinking about the no-fault or PIP days. I think that if the court allows evidence of the amount billed and the amount paid, and the jury hears all of that evidence and decides, and the court knows that it has heard all of that evidence, so they come back with a number for economic damages that is based upon having heard all of that evidence, I'm not sure that there is a function for the court to perform at that point in time post-verdict to reduce anything. I think the jury's already taken care of that.
And so you think that if the jury were to determine, as you know, as you put it, let's say they billed $1,000 and $500 is what the insurance allows, and the jury, for whatever reason, decides to compensate at $700, then when you get to collateral source, somehow the $200 that never has to be paid is not a collateral source.
I think the argument would still be made. I think the issue would be presented to the trial court, but I think a trial judge in that situation, having sat through the trial, having fashioned the jury instructions, having heard the evidence of both amounts billed and amounts paid, would have to take all of that into consideration in deciding whether they were going to do the math, you know, post-verdict. That's kind of the way that the no-fault statute sort of evolved. It started out with the idea that the court would subtract from jury verdicts the amount paid by no-fault insurance. But what it evolved into was instructions to jurors telling them that they couldn't award damages that were paid or payable by no-fault or PIP insurance. So when we got verdicts in those cases, the court didn't have to do the math anymore because the jury had made a determination as to what the reasonable amount of those medical expenses were. And I see jurors properly instructed under this system performing that same function, but performing it with their eyes open in terms of what was actually paid as well as what was billed and any other expert testimony that may be presented in terms of making that reasonableness determination. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
If I may, Your Honor, Bill Hansen again on behalf of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. What we're dealing here with is Judge Pratt's order that allows both amounts in, and somehow we are trying to reconcile a rule of damages with a rule of evidence under Rule 403. I don't want to discuss it a lot, all the intricacies. I think one case, though, however, we've had a lot of questions about the complexities of the trials, the costs, and these types of things. One case demands that this court really look at it very, very carefully, and it actually has not gotten any references in the briefs. It was just decided a year ago, and it is decided adverse to our position, and that is Stanley v. Walker out of the Indiana Supreme Court, 906 Northeast 2nd, 852. It's a divided court, 3-2. With a very lengthy discussion by Justice Dixon in dissent. And that directly deals with allowing both amounts in, and Justice Dixon gets into the parade of horribles, the Pandora's box, that says pragmatically you cannot do it without leaving the jury with some idea as to what these two amounts represent. You are inviting confusion. It is an incomplete question without looking at the actual source of the payment. On the other hand, you have cases like Covington out of South Carolina, Leitinger out of Wisconsin, Wills out of Illinois, which say absolutely 403, we are not going to let this sideshow take over the circus, as Mr. Thomason indicated. But in Stanley, I think that the court should look at the dissent in that case, the pragmatic issues raised by the dissent in that case, and then dovetail them with this court's decision of just a year, 2 years ago in Hoyle v. Pioneer Sand, dealing with ramifications of putting on income taxes, and the Colorado Court of Appeals on prejudgment interest in Voight, where you get into concerns about jury nullification of a rule, relevance, speculation, diverting the distracting the jury's attention, increasing the cost and complexity of litigation, and just the overall confusion. It's just overwhelming to allow two amounts in without some explanation, and that explanation must be the existence of a collateral source. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands.